Good morning. Welcome to the House Judiciary Policy and Finance Committee for Tuesday, February 14th. The clerk will take the roll call.
Representative Ron Szymanski.
Present.
Representative Mazzarol.
Here.
Representative Johnson.
Yes.
Representative Allen.
Here.
Representative Anderson.
Here.
Representative Champion. Representative Cornish.
Here.
Representative Grunhagen.
Here.
Representative Hillstrom. Representative Kreisel. Representative Lane. Representative Lesch.
Here.
Representative Liebling.
Presente.
Representative Shoemaker. Representative Smith.
Here.
Representative Swazinski.
Here.
Representative Vogel.
Here.
And Representative Wardlow.
Quorum is present. Next item on the agenda is approval of minutes of our previous meeting. The chair would note that there is one correction to the minutes. The spelling of Representative Gauthier's name will be corrected by the clerk. Do we have a motion to approve the minutes? Representative Grunhagen moves the minutes of the previous meeting. Any discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. Minutes are approved. Okay, this morning we're holding an informational hearing on the Minnesota Board of Judicial Standards. We've looked at our schedule and wanted to hear a little bit more on the work of the Judicial Standards Board, pardon me. And we will call them forward now for their testimony. So if I could have the folks from the Minnesota Board of Judicial Standards come to the testifying table. And good morning. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is David Paul. I'm the Executive Secretary to the Board on Judicial Standards. And I've been asked by Representative Szymanski and his staff to come down here and just generally talk about the work of the board and answer what questions you may have. The Board on Judicial Standards is the only agency in the state of Minnesota that deals with complaints or processes complaints alleging that judges have acted inappropriately from a personal standpoint, and I'll get into that in a little more detail in just a moment. When a judge engages in personal misconduct, that is a violation of the Code of Judicial Conduct, which is a written document in the rules of court. And the board, in addition to that, also deals with disability cases, that is, cases which allege that a judge is sufficiently disabled in terms of mental or physical health so as to make his or her tenure on the bench untenable. And we don't get too many cases like that. We did complete one last year. In which the kind of the reverse happened. The judge thought that he was disabled sufficiently to be retired, and the governor asked us to look into it, and eventually the case was resolved on a private basis. The judge is now back to work, but that is pretty rare. Most of our cases are deal with actual judicial misconduct. The jurisdiction of the board includes district judges, includes appellate judges, both the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court. It includes any referees, child support magistrates, any active retired judges. The board's jurisdiction extends to any judge or any person performing neutral judicial decisional duties who are paid by the judicial branch. So, for example, the executive the branch judges, such as unemployment judges, would not be under our jurisdiction because they are not paid by the judicial branch. There are also other types of, there are several types of executive department judges that are in our jurisdiction by agreement or kind of interesting way of phrasing statutes. The Minnesota Tax Court is within our jurisdiction, and that is purely by agreement. They are executive court, executive branch judges. The Workers' Compensation Court of Appeals is within our jurisdiction. Again, strictly executive department judges, yet they have agreed to be subject to the board's rules. And the administrative law judge, this is the interesting part in terms of statute, the administrative, the Office of Administrative Hearings, which houses the administrative law judges and the district hearing workers' compensation judges, are not within our jurisdiction. However, the chief administrative law judge is within our jurisdiction, and in this case, it's he, Judge Krause, at this particular point in time, because he's under our jurisdiction. Part of the code is to supervise judges that you have the duty to supervise adequately from a standpoint of judicial ethics. And so, in a sense, all the administrative judges are kind of under our jurisdiction, but only through the fact that the administrative law judge, the chief administrative law judge, is under our jurisdiction. In addition, the board does, this is the main core function of the board, is to process these complaints and bring them forward where the board feels that that is appropriate to do. In addition, the board has a special assignment from the legislature, which it has had for many, many years, to enforce compliance with MS 546.27. Also, there are various other equivalents to that statute. For example, in the tax court, it's chapter 270. But the statute basically is called the 90-day statute. In the tax court, it's the 3-month statute. But it basically says that any motion, any decision must be filed within 90 days of the date of submission, and submission, of course, being a term of art, referring to that point in time at which everything that a judicial officer would need to decide a case was in. All the briefs, all the testimony, everything in. And then at that point, the period begins to run. And the legislature, under that law, gives the board the first shot in enforcing that. So we get, unfortunately, we get 2 months late, but we do get lists of cases that have been decided late, and we pursue those along with other cases that we have. We also try to work with judges and judicial officers in a kind of an education program. We work with judges, we work with the general public, we work with the legislature to advise them of what the code says and what the procedures of the board are, pretty much like I'm doing now. And we also take phone calls from judges who have ethical dilemmas that they are trying to resolve. And I just give them informal advice over the phone, and I try to do the best job I can with that. And also, the judge has the option, always, a judge or judicial officer has the option of sending us a more formal request in writing with a question. And at that point, we then respond in writing. And we have a number of, these are called informal advisory opinions. The board has issued many, many of them over the years. They can be quite helpful. This year we have put together a index of all of these decisions, and I'm looking forward to publishing them on the internet fairly soon. I haven't done it yet just because of other priorities. Sometimes the work of the board gets very, very heavy in terms of volume, and sometimes these extra projects have to go to the wayside for a short while because I'm the only person in the board other than my assistant. But that index should be coming out fairly soon. The index has a big disclaimer on it saying that, you know, it's not a question of precedent. You can't take a decision by a former board and automatically say that it's going to be applied to a certain situation. The rules change, boards change, laws change, but it's a good thing to do, and it's better than not doing it. And so I'm happy to have the authorization from the board to at last do it. As I said, I work on the phone with judges. Of course, I work with citizens and lawyers also who have questions about the process or a certain item of conduct. Of course, we do the other administrative duties that are required of agencies, and that is basically the function of my assistant, my associate. She does the administrative and accounting functions. The board works pursuant to rules which the legislature gave the Supreme Court the duty to write, and they have existed for quite a number of years. The last time they were revised were in 2009. There were some important changes made at that time. One thing is always necessary to discuss when I'm talking about the activities of the board is it's the important limitation it has on its authority. And the problem is that people perceive the board often as either part of the court system or perceive it as having some kind of power over the court system, or perhaps perceive it as a dual functioning judiciary. In other words, it can do the same thing as the court. And that is not the case. The board has no authority. As a matter of fact, it's specifically limited, as are most similar boards, as are all similar boards and commissions throughout the country. Limited to personal misconduct. It cannot review a case for error and or mistake. That must be personal conduct, and it's an important distinction because so many people call me with these types of problems. They call up and they say, you know, what is happening here? The judge has ruled he or she is entirely wrong. I've taken a terrible beating in this case, and I know that you oversee the judges, so can you help me? And just on the basis of that information, the answer is no, because we have no authority, for example, to go to that judge and say, judge, you made a mistake here. You must change this. Or judge, you have to rule this way. We have no authority to do that, because to do that would be the same as calling us a court, which we are not. And courts, of course, are drawn by the Constitution, and we are just a creature of statute. But it is an important part of educating people so that they know that we cannot do something. And then what happens is that sometimes if they get the impression that we can, they don't do what they should do. Perhaps appeal the case or go back to the judge, go back to the court, and try to get it changed by appealing to the people who have the power to do it. And so it's important. That's an important aspect of my duty, I think, is to try to explain that, and try to explain that limitation, and try to get people on the right track. Some people just don't want to accept it, but most people understand it. they understand that there cannot be two judicial systems in our state. Otherwise, there would be hopeless amounts of conflict and all kinds of chaos. But it's the most important thing to remember about the board is this important limitation on its authority. Examples of misconduct, you know, and this is when I talk to people, I often give examples like this. Conflicts of interest, for example, if maybe within a short period of time, a judge is trying to rule on a case where his or her former law firm is one of the parties. That, of course, extends out over time and eventually disappears just without more evidence, without some other factor interceding. Improper communication with one side. This happens quite a bit. A judge may all of a sudden call in a family law case a guardian or have a private conversation or something like that. Happens all the time, and it's the kind of thing that we do a lot of in terms of processing. Improper courtroom conduct is another. Demeanor is a consistent problem. The important thing to remember about our limitation is, and I tell this, try to make this very clear to everyone, just because we cannot look into a problem, a specific problem, because it is beyond our authority, that doesn't mean that the judge did everything correctly or didn't do anything correctly. All it means is that you have to go to the people who have the authority to decide that, and that, of course, is not us. And an interesting thing about it is that the types of things we do have really nothing to do with the actual decision. I often kind of bring up a dumb example with people I talk to, and of course I warn them that a dumb example is coming, but I say, you know, if your mother or your brother were sitting on that bench ruling on your case, you can see that would be a problem. Right? Of course, everybody agrees, yes, this would be a terrible problem. And I say, note that this person, your mother or your brother, could rule in your favor, and or could rule not in your favor, but the problem would still remain. So, and it kind of exemplifies to people the difference between the types of things we do, which have nothing to do with the ultimate decision, and the types of things that courts do, which, of course, is all about deciding disputed issues. My basic procedure, typically I will get a letter from somebody and or a phone call, but on a letter, I review the letter to determine whether or not there are any allegations in the letter that the board has the authority to process. And of course, if you get a letter saying that, you know, this judge, he ruled in the exact wrong way. He didn't pay any attention to the law. He violated my constitutional rights. He violated the Family Law Act. He violated the Landlord-Tenant Act. These are things which are important and must be resolved, but they cannot be resolved by us. So I under the rules, I have the power to write them back and say, no, this is not something that we have the authority over. You must go to the courts for this. Most often, a letter has both. It has both allegations that we can't consider and allegations that we absolutely must consider. And this is the typical type of letter. And so I automatically divide them up. Of course, I show the whole letter to the board and let it make the final decision. But most cases that we have are a combination of matters over which the board can exert its authority and matters over which the board cannot exert its authority. Let me just move on to the appropriation side of things, because this House and the Senate passed a bill several years ago which has made a tremendous difference in the operation of the board. Of course, consistently, the board's largest and most unpredictable and most inconsistent expenses relate to the investigations of serious cases and the public hearings which sometimes result. If the board finds that there is reasonable cause to pursue a matter, it does so. It proposes a corrective measure of some type, and usually those corrective measures are accepted, and these cases all resolve, and this happens about 98% of the time. Sometimes, however, the judge does not agree that the corrective measure proposed by the board is appropriate, and in that event, the judge or judicial officer has a full right to a very, very carefully run hearing filled with due process protections, disclosure as to the evidence. There's a high standard of proof, the clear and convincing evidentiary standard, which is the highest standard you can have in a civil case. Of course, the criminal cases are much higher. But the board holds public hearings. Like any legal proceeding, lawyers' fees are involved. We have to get a courtroom. We have to get court reporters. These things are expensive. They're all the necessary components of a hearing are paid for by the board. And, of course, the board is not in direct control of when this is going to happen. So you might get a period of 5 years where it happens only once in a while. Then you can get a period like the last couple of years, which all of a sudden there were four hearings and something like six cases. And that was extremely complicated and extremely burdensome for the board and the citizens, because it was very expensive. There's might point out kind of hopefully now that there's nothing on the horizon, so there does not appear to be any reason to, we have no hearings pending or anything like that, so it kind of is what I sat here and described it to be last year, which it appeared to be kind of a bubble, and it appears to be over. Of course, in years past, the board had problems because it did not have any money, had no budget, a very small amount of budget, $15,000-$20,000, to do these things. And we would get in these deficiency positions since these hearings could not be postponed under the due process standards. And we were constantly coming to the board with substantial deficit requests. And in I think since 2002, I've been with the board since about 1999, but since 2002, we had made four deficiency requests, that would be one each session. And in 2008, the legislature passed a revolving appropriation line item for us, which is $125,000 per year. And it just kind of, we use it and it just kind of fills up the next year. So it's a total of, can be a total of $250,000 over a two-year period. If we don't use it, it just goes right back. With that money, we were able to do several things which I think in the long run saved the state money. In that, before, in our deficit situation, we couldn't even hire an investigator. We had no money to do it. So we would impose upon our lawyers, who of course were waiting for their money, to do the investigation for us. And they would charge us at a reasonable rate, but at a rate that was obviously designed to make them some money at a profit. And of course, we could get these things cheaper if we had hired it directly ourselves. One of the terrific things that this revolving appropriation did is it allowed us to do that. And so we were able to investigate these cases preliminarily at a lesser rate. And that's been very helpful to us. And the board will forever be indebted to the legislature for voting that special revolving appropriation. Just a brief update as to what we've done. I have full statistics now for 2010, but I am working on the statistics for 2011 at this point. But the 2011 statistics will not be very different than these statistics which I'm about to give you now. Just briefly, in 2010, we processed over 1,400 calls and letters from the general public and from lawyers. We processed 363 inquiries from judges and judicial officers. These are judges asking questions. We issued 4 advisory opinions. This is the more formal process that judges and judicial officers sometimes use to get an opinion from the board. We formally investigated over 120 cases, and again, this will be about the same for this year. We issued 2 public reprimands, 12 private admonitions, issued 9 letters of caution. Letters of caution are non-disciplinary types of letters in which the board expresses its view that some conduct might be a problem if it continued in the future. And it's been a fairly useful tool. In terms of effectiveness of judicial oversight, and Ryan Blodgett and Representative Szymanski, I think, wanted me to just touch on this because it's an important aspect. You know, there's been a big change in the board's rules from and after 2009, July 1st, 2009. Prior to that, the board was able to stand apart from the process a little bit, was able to appear to be a little more neutral. It had the panel for the public hearings only had the power to recommend to the board that a case be resolved in some way, and the board itself had the power to consider that recommendation, sustain it or not sustain it, and then recommend to the Supreme Court how the case should resolve. And the board would, again, usually, even after having caused the case to go to public hearing in the first place, now took the benefit of the transcript back with it, reviewed the code again. It was open. The decision was always open until the time came to give the recommendation to the Supreme Court. Under the new rules, things have changed. Now the board is more of a party. The panel has the power to make its rulings and to do so in a final way, unless, of course, either the judge or judicial officer or the board appeals. So the board's role is a little more advocacy in nature, not as neutral as it once was. But it's, I don't know how substantial a change that is. Has this rule change made a difference in the effectiveness of the board? I don't think so. There are definitely changes, but it's just kind of the same thing, only it must be pursued in a different way. From my standpoint, from the administration standpoint, the rules are still the same for me. I advise judicial officers about their questions. I don't tell the board about it, so that the judicial officer is comfortable knowing that, you know, something that they may in fact turn out to be doing wrong would be able to be acted on by the board just by telling me, and that would not be a good way to put out advice. And so I still am able to do that. At the end of the day, I think that the board, regardless of what rules were pursued, and some of these cases were pursued under the old rules, some pursued under the new rules, I think the board was able to pursue what it felt was important. I don't have a vote in that. I just process them. But that is something I felt that the board did competently and accurately. Some boards are more active than others. Some courts are more active than others. Some panels are more active than others. The next board may not or may be as active as previous boards. It remains to be seen. But what I'm trying to say here is that I think the level of activity on the board is very much dependent on who is on the board. And this changes over the years. It changes to some degree every 2 years. And in 12 years, I've seen many changes. I've seen boards that were not very active. I've seen boards that were extremely active. That is the key to how the board reacts. Some people may feel that the board, when it is in a more inactive phase, should be more active. Some people may feel the opposite. But no matter what position the board takes, you can be sure that there will be people on both sides to criticize or commend the board. Can I answer any questions for anybody?
Certainly, Mr. Paul. Representative Johnson has the first question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You were kind of getting it towards the end here, Mr. Paul, but could you say a little bit about the board, who's on it, and who appoints them, how long they serve, that sort of thing, just have some idea of who this judicial board is?
Mr. Paul.
Through the chair. The board is made up of 10 people, one of which is a court of appeals judge, three of which are district court judges, two of which are lawyers, and four of which are people called from the general citizenry, not lawyers, not judges. They serve four-year terms. The most they can serve is two terms. And about every 2 years, we see a change. The lawyers and the public members are confirmed by the Senate. The judges, however, are not confirmed by the Senate. They do not have to go through any confirmation process. All of the board members are appointed by the government.
Okay. Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Paul. I'm a lay person, so I'm not associated with the legal system. Most of my association has been playing basketball for about 10 years with two judges and some lawyers, okay? And if I followed them, they wanted to have a, or if I claimed I followed them, they wanted to have a short jury session to figure out whether it was true or not. But anyway, just kidding. Hey, just a couple of questions to help me better understand. So if a complaint comes into the board, and I have had some concerns and complaints by constituents about the Board of Judicial Standards and also the responses. So if a complaint comes in, my understanding is you issue a letter to them within a reasonable period of time, I assume, and then that letter or response is also posted on the internet, or you plan to do that in the future? Is that correct?
Mr. Paul.
Mr. Chairman, no, we do not ever publish letters that we get from anyone on the internet. Our board, this is something I probably should have spoke to earlier, our board works on a confidential basis. The only thing that we were publishing on the internet was the judicial opinions, the opinions the board had issued to judicial officers over the years. And we're not even going to associate any of those opinions with names. They will appear without names. Those are purely for education. No, the letters that you are speaking of are treated with specific confidence by the board and by me. And the reason is very clear. It is not easy to mount a complaint against the judge. Judges are very powerful in our society. And it has to be recognized that people who are not as powerful still may have complaints. And one of the most common issues is that they don't want to injure their case. In many cases, the judge is still presiding over their case. And, of course, they don't want necessarily the judge. You know, some don't care. Some say, you know, send this complaint to the judge. But most people are concerned that at least for the initial period, that nobody know about the complaint. And it's a good rule, and I'll tell you why. It gives a complainant, and I'm including lawyers and judges here, too, because we get complaints from lawyers and judges in addition to the citizenry. It gives all of these complainants a free look. It's a look. The first of all, I take a look, and if the allegations are not something the board can handle, then it's treated a certain way. And by the way, when I write back to the complainants, those letters are always reviewed by the board. So if there's any mistakes made, they get corrected eventually by the board. But and then of course if the complaint does have allegations that the board may decide upon, then it does. These allegations go to the board, and if the board feels that there's not sufficient cause to go forward, now they call it reasonable cause. Again, nobody tells the judge about the existence of the complaint. That would just be counterproductive. Sometimes the judge knows anyway, because the complainant tells them, or maybe sometimes comes out in the news that somebody filed a complaint, but mostly the judge, 98% of the judges never know that complaints have been filed against them. And because there is the board does not find the reasonable cause that it needs to go forward. But again, from a person of a standpoint who's filing a complaint, this is a good thing because it gives them a look. It gives them a chance to test what their complaint is against what the board will do. And I don't mean to imply that judges would hear that a complaint had been filed against them and that they would become prejudiced and impartial and rule against them. That's rarely the case, and it's not only against the rules, but it's rarely the case. But yeah, it does happen, but it is rarely the case. But it makes people have confidence in the fact that the board will take a good look at their letters without having to deal with the issue of whether or not their cases may be damaged.
Okay. Representative Grunhagen.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, thank you for that response, Mr. Paul. A lot of these concerns seem to center around, I would say this, and it tends to be in the area of a divorce court, okay? And I know those are extremely difficult situations with the allegations and the emotions and the children involved at times. But one of the consistent complaints is that they believe, if a person believes that the judge is consistently ruling outside of statute and they've done their homework, and according to what you've testified here today, if they file a complaint on that basis, that is really outside of your jurisdiction. And the only recourse for the person, if they believe that the judge is consistently ruling outside of the law, is to go back to the court system. Is that correct?
Mr. Paul.
Mr. Chairman, basically that is correct. If the only fact, let's just take a real theoretical case, if the only fact is the judge has ruled against them time and time again, that may not be something that is correct in terms of whether the rulings are correct. But it is nothing for us to consider because we can't tell the judge, change the way you're ruling. We have no authority over that. And to do so the board would be acting as if it was a court. And that, again, would cause a lot of problems.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Grunhagen.
Yeah, so if I understand that correctly, is there any, if a judge is ruling consistently in cases outside of the law, is there any organization or group that critiques those rulings, or is that left to the judicial system itself?
Mr. Paul.
Mr. Chairman. Yeah, let me, and before I answer that question, the answer to that question I think would be no, because there can be no agency that can say anything about a judicial ruling as to whether or not it is proper or not. But I should probably qualify what I said to you before with regard to the other answer. There are cases where judges, for example, in criminal cases, refuse to appoint an attorney for an indigent person and do it on a periodic basis, do it in a pattern type of way, do it consistently. There are judges who violate the who do basically what you say, and if it's serious enough, and if it's so outside their authority that it doesn't make any sense, that can be a violation of judicial conduct. For example, if a judge read a ruling and said, "Well, I'm not going to enforce that ruling. That ruling's stupid. I'm not going to enforce it." You know, that could be a problem. I mean, that because it's a direct ruling, and the judge is saying, "I'm not going to enforce it." Why? Because of some personal reason. I mean, either a judge always has to enforce other rulings from the appellate system. I mean, to not do that could be a problem. There are those few cases, and I mean, when you put them all together, there's many of them, but it's pretty rare. But there are those cases where judges act totally beyond their authority, and those cases can be considered by the board and have been.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Gruenhagen.
Just a final question. You talked about having issued 4 deficiencies in the last several years. When is the last time the board ever my understanding is if the board recommends removal of a judge, they have to recommend that to the Minnesota Supreme Court, and they actually act on that. Has there ever been a time where the board recommended a removal of the judge in the last 25 or 30 years, to your knowledge?
Mr. Paul.
Mr. Chairman, yes, there have been several requests. The most recent one would be in the case of Judge Karasoff, where she was alleged to have and was ultimately found to have been living outside of her district in violation of the Constitution. Now, this would not cause the board to seek her removal. Just move back in and, you know, don't do it again. And there would probably be maybe some kind of public corrective measure involved, but it was not that big a deal. But she had communicated with the board in ways which the board felt was not honest, not genuine. And this, again, was also affirmed by court. But so in that case, the board sought her removal on the grounds that if a judge is not being honest with the board, what kind of authority can she maintain over normal people? Again, the Supreme Court did not agree. The Supreme Court suspended her for a very, very long time, 6 months unpaid, but they did not agree with the board. Another case would be the Judge Blakely case. There have been more than these cases, but these are examples. Judge Blakely, you may recall, or maybe you don't know anything about it, got a discount on his own lawyer's bill for his divorce by referring cases without telling anybody about it, without disclosing anybody about it, by referring cases to this lawyer and saying, and then writing them emails and saying, you know, I've referred you all these cases, how about a discount? You know, that kind of thing. We didn't think that was Judge Blakely should continue. Again, we were not sustained. So I mean, it does happen. I just wanted to, if I may, just go back to another point. I mean, you said, Representative, that you know that you get a lot of complaints from people involved in divorces and custody battles. You know, actually, there are several leading factors. In the family law, it's usually over 30% in any year that we have complaints relating to family law. Another growing area is probate, where there's just tremendous emotions involved, and people are just so having such difficulty with it. You are absolutely correct that any type of emotional action, which you know there's tons of them in the courts, becomes a category for the board. Something that we recognize very, very clearly.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Paul. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Paul, a couple questions for you. You said that you received 1,400 calls and letters. How many basically written complaints did you receive in 2010?
We received, I don't quite have this broken down, we received about 124 complaints over which the board conducted some formal investigation. And we received something like 1,350 other contacts, most of which were calls, but some of which were letters. And I would say that maybe between 8 and 12 letters per month. I would say between 1 and 200 letters per year were received by the board, and the rest would be phone calls.
Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Paul, the complaint that I receive is that people send you these letters, these complaints, you know, maybe thick packets of complaints about judges, and then they don't hear back from the board. Can you address that issue?
Mr. Paul.
Yes, that is just not true. I respond faithfully to every letter I get. There is nobody who has written the board who has not received a response. There are people who, I don't think the type of people you talk to, people who send us like 10 faxes a week, and we talk to them a variety of number of times. They just don't want to accept what the limitations of the board is. But no, that never happens. There's always some response when we get a letter.
So,
Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Paul, in the letter that you respond to the people, then you do clarify that I can't deal with your complaint because it does not deal with something that's in our authority. I mean, do you specifically tell the person why you're not responding, why you can't do anything regarding their complaint specifically?
Yes, ma'am, I do.
You put that in your letter. Thank you.
All right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Next is Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Paul, I was friends after law school, a buddy of mine who clerked for a federal judge, and that federal judge is one of his favorite sayings on a particularly sunny summer afternoon. He'd say, I'm going to go play golf, and anyone who has a problem with that can go round up 67 senators, which, of course, you need to impeach. In the Minnesota system, of course, it's different. We hold judges accountable by elections. And I'm wondering, when people are frustrated with a particular judge's conduct, whether it is a matter of law or personal misconduct, are you familiar with situations where these individuals, in being unable to secure some kind of relief they want through your board, that they have successfully mounted a campaign to defeat that judge at the ballot box?
Mr. Paul.
Mr. Chairman. Representative, I'm aware of several cases like that. It's interesting that you bring that up. You know, under the code, it is a state judge's duty to give his or her first priority to the job, not to playing golf, to the job. It doesn't mean a judge can't play golf, but it certainly means that a judge can't prefer other activity over the activity of presiding in cases. And that is part of the code of judicial conduct, a very strong part of it. Yes, there are several cases where judges have been overturned in connection with, or judges have failed to obtain re-election after they had been disciplined.
Or even anything brought
to the flesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Or anything that was even brought to your board that didn't rise to any other kind of complaint level or what have you. So, yes, that failing to be disciplined would be one option.
Mr. Paul.
Chair. There are several examples of the first case that you mentioned. There may be examples of the second category of case that you mentioned where the board acted with regard to a judge and did not work in a public manner, but worked in a private manner. And that judge may have been unsuccessful at the next election. I think that there are such cases. I can't be specific, so I don't want to be able to say that there have been cases. Sure, but I think that there have been some cases.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Lesh. No further questions. Great, Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Paul, let me get this straight. Hearing your testimony, I have a question, and I think you can answer it in one word. I think it's probably going to be yes. But in response to a previous representative's question, you constructed a hypothetical about someone writing you with a complaint that the judge time and time ruled against them. I believe I heard you testify that your function, your role, and your authority is to investigate and help correct a judge who has acted intemperately from the bench or arrogantly or prejudicially, not to make a finding if the judge ruled outside of a statute or did not provide justice. That person... area of redress is to the next higher court, Court of Appeals or Supreme Court, but not you. Isn't that correct?
Mr. Paul.
The Chair, the answer to that question is yes. Thank you. My only qualification is there are those cases, as we discussed, where a judge acts completely beyond his or her authority. And that, you know, those types of cases that we discussed, those can be exceptions to that. But if you don't have the fact of the judge acted beyond, or the allegation that the judge acted beyond his or her authority. The only fact you have is that this judge ruled consistently against a certain person, really isn't very much we can do at that point. It's not for us to do.
Thank you. All right. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Paul, I have a couple areas I want to ask you about. The first is about just general supervision of judges, because it's been my observation for some time that there's really nobody who provides sort of daily supervision of the work of judges. For example, in judicial districts, there's a chief judge, but that chief judge does not supervise the other judges. For example, things that might not rise to the level of coming to your board, such as, you know, a judge who, say, is late every day, or disappears on Thursday afternoon to golf or something like that, that there's nobody really whose role it is to simply say to that judge, you know, you really got to shape up. This doesn't look good. This isn't good. We don't want this, you know, to sort of shape their behavior short of making a formal complaint. So I'd like you to comment on that, first of all, if you see that as an issue. And then I have another question as well, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Paul.
Mr. Chairman, thank you for saving your second question, because the answer to this one is a little bit involved. You know, you are generally correct in saying that judges have no supervisor. Yeah. They have the higher courts to determine whether or not they made correct rulings, but they are elected officials. And it is a problem. I mean, it's not to say that a chief judge or some other judge, some mentor judge somewhere, or just a judge who's a friend of another judge hasn't gone up to a judge and said, you know, you're showing up late all the time, or you're playing a little too much golf, you're neglecting your duties. I mean, I have several cases like that right now. That's the interesting part. Judges do talk. They do try to help each other and try to assure that each of them acts within the purview of the code. But, you know, interestingly, I have cases like that, right? I have a case, at least several cases right now, and I've had cases where just judges have been consistently late. There's cases where judges would not show up for several weeks. You know, these cases do get to us. There are also those cases that take place which do not get to us. But it doesn't mean that there's not something being done. Of course, sometimes nothing is being done and something should be done. You have all these factors swirling around, but we do get some of these cases, and judges also help each other without regard to us.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Paul. Well, yeah, and you know, I'm sure that's the case, often the case. I'm not sure I think it's good that we don't have a system in place, because it's kind of happenstance, right, whether somebody's colleague says something to them, and often people don't want to do that. But anyway, my second question is whether how we compare to other states. Do other states have more what we might call robust systems of disciplining judges? Do they do it pretty much like we do? Can you just give us a really brief? I know there are 50 states, and it's hard, maybe, but you must have some idea of where we fall in the scheme of things.
Mr. Paul.
First of all, let me just address the first comment you made, which you said that you were disturbed because the system is a little happenstance. It's a little, and you're right. I mean, a complaint system is always going to be happenstance, as you put it, because it depends on a complaint. Some people file complaints and some people don't. I always try to encourage the filing of complaints, because without them, we never know what happens. I mean, at least if they're gone through and they're rejected, at least we've done that. But some people have what I consider to be very serious allegations of misconduct and never file complaints. If some people don't and file complaints all the time. But that's what we have with complaints. As to other states, I think this is a good question and a good opportunity for me to place the judiciary in Minnesota in some type of perspective, because we have serious cases in Minnesota. We don't have very many serious cases in Minnesota, and the cases that we have in Minnesota are not like the cases that you see across the country. I mean, if I could sit down with you for a half hour and tell you some of the stories that these are not really stories, they're actual cases that come up, you would be shocked at the poor level of judicial behavior in other states. From the standpoint of what we do here, we're very happy with the level of personal conduct in the judiciary. We were in the Supreme Court not long ago arguing a case. One of the judges said to our lawyer, "Well, this is not a case that we get all the time." And our lawyer said, "Yes," and we're very happy about that. And it really shows that when we get a serious case, it is not a very common occurrence.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Paul. Representative Allen, you have a question? And I urge you to keep the question and the answer brief. We have several other people that want to testify today.
Okay. Mr. Chair, Mr. Paul, my question is, I understand that if you can't review a particular ruling in that would be subject to appeal, and that should be decided by a higher court. But you keep talking about this exception, about that if a judge is acting. So if a judge is ruling outside their authority or acting outside their authority? I'm trying to figure out what. Give me an example of that,
Mr. Paul.
Mr. Chairman. Yeah, this is a difficult area. I mean, if let's say a person feels that they should be able to pursue their case without filing fees. And the status of that is a Latin phrase called informa pauperis. It's not, you don't have the money to, you can proceed without the filing fees because you don't have the money to pay them. And we get a lot of complaints about those types of things where they are ruled against. And, you know, the thing the board watches for is there a scenario in which the judge's decision could be justified, and if there is anything at all, and if it is within the judge's authority, I mean, the judge rules on that particular issue, and it is within his or her authority. It's going to be impossible for the board to act on it. It's just these cases where, and they're more, you'll know them when you see them. It's when the appeals court comes down and says, "You must rule this way. You must do this," and the judge just says, "Well, I'm not going to do it." You know, it's that kind of a blatant thing, and it's difficult to describe. It's not as difficult to recognize.
Okay.
Thank you,
Mr. Paul. Our next testifier is Mr. Dale Nathan. And for those of you that are on the list to testify, if you'd make your way forward so we can carry on the hearing. So move to the front row if you like, and we will expedite the testimony here. Good morning, Mr. Nathan. Please introduce yourself for the tape and proceed with your testimony. And we do have several people on the list, so I ask you to be as brief as possible.
Thank you very much for allowing me to testify. My name is Dale Nathan, N-A-T-H-A-N. I am a former practicing lawyer. I'm not in practice at the present time. I'm going to limit my testimony to about 4 minutes in the interest of time, and because there are several other people here who have important testimony to give you. But I would like to give you a brief background of myself because it illustrates the problem. And the question is, the issue, is effective oversight being made of the judicial branch of government? And if not, what can or should the legislature do about it? I, for one, sincerely appreciate your taking the time to look into this issue. I came to Minnesota in 1965. And became the general counsel of what was then Sperry Univac. I left Sperry Univac, which is now Lockheed Martin, in 1978, and I have been in private practice ever since. In the year 2000, I was representing a woman and her born out of wedlock child in Dakota County District Court. During that representation, it was in Scott County actually, I was ordered by the judge. His name is Judge Tim Blakely. He's no longer a judge. I was ordered by him, tell me what your client told you. The circumstances were that the 4-year-old daughter of the mother was being sexually abused by the biological father, according to the psychologist who we had evaluate the child. And Judge Blakely decided that I'm going to force that mother to make her child available for unsupervised visitation with the biological father. I did not know where the mother was hiding because she was in hiding. I appeared before Judge Blakely, and he ordered me to tell him where the mother and child were. I did not know. I didn't want to know. And that's when he told me, tell me what your client told you. And I said, Judge, I can't do that. That's attorney-client privileged. I have an obligation to my client to keep these communications confidential. And Judge Blakely said, either you tell me what your client told you, or you're going to jail. About 2 weeks later, I was in jail, a practicing lawyer. I was there for 7 weeks until the appeals court finally said, well, it's clear he is not going to disclose what his client told him. Let him out. But they said that the judge had every right to issue that order and put me in jail without a trial, without a jury, without anything. 3 years later, in 2003, the Lawyers Professional Responsibility Board began to prosecute me. They claimed that I was unethical because I refused to comply with a court order. Eventually, I appeared before the Minnesota Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court ruled you cannot violate a judge's order. That is unethical. And they took away my license. And they said, Mr. Nathan, you're suspended for 6 months, but you can apply. First, you have to admit that you're wrong and apologize and take disciplinary training. And to this day, I have not done that because I was not wrong. I was right. Judges have no authority, in my mind, to order me to do anything unethical. They claim they can even order me to break the law. And that's not true. Since 2004, I have made all the efforts I can to reform our system. And that's a tall order. Many of you, I'm sure, have received letters that I've sent trying to inform you of what's happened in Minnesota, all throughout the nation, actually, and suggesting ways that we can provide effective oversight of our judiciary. You're going to hear from many people I've tried to help. They are going to tell you that judges routinely refuse to comply with your statutes, properly enacted statutes, like the criteria for determining custody of a child. They ignore it. These people will tell you about outright violations of our constitutions. In one case right now, a judge ordered a woman to take down her blog and will not let her have any contact with her four young children because she is exercising her right of free speech to publish a blog. She will tell you about that shortly. We have another person who's going to testify that his seven children were taken from him and put in foster care at $1,000 a month per child for reasons that make absolutely no sense. This judge, according to this witness, is clearly incompetent, but there's no place he can go. And that's the problem with the Judicial Standards Board. They have no authority to provide oversight of judges' decisions, of judges' actions. And that's what we are lacking today. At this point, I'm going to, again, as I say, limit my testimony. I am open for questions.
All right.
And with that, I'll stop.
All right. Representative Smith, do you want to address your question now, or would you prefer to wait till the other testifiers have appeared?
Mr. Chair, there are brief questions. I'd like to ask them now. Mr. Nathan, you indicated at the outset here, first of all, did you cause that additional camera to be brought into this chamber?
Additional what?
Camera.
Oh, no, that's not normal.
Okay.
That's not me.
Mr. Nathan, you indicated at the outset that you're a former attorney, not now practicing, yet during your testimony you said you're in private practice ever since. Are you practicing law or are you not?
I am not practicing law today. I did not practice law after my license was suspended.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Nathan, when was it suspended and why?
Mr. Nathan.
Briefly.
Chair, Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, it was suspended in November of 2003. It was suspended because I had violated a court order.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Nathan.
Smith, Representative Smith.
You've recounted your run-in with a judge 22 years ago. Testimony today was from the Minnesota Board of Judicial Standards, which is in place to oversee the conduct of judges, not their decisions, but their conduct. If that isn't good, is that good enough for you, yes or no? Most questions can be answered with a yes, no, or I don't know. So is that enough, yes or no? And if not specifically, what more do you want now?
Mr. Nathan.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Representative Smith, that is not good enough. That particular judge was brought before the Judicial Standards Board.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Nathan, I don't want to hear about that testimony. I want to know, what do you want to improve on the Board of Judicial Standards, or in addition to that, or in replacement of that, from now going forward?
Mr. Nathan.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Smith, the Judicial Standards Board, in my opinion, should be transferred to the legislative branch of government pursuant to Article 6, Section 9, and the legislature should provide the oversight of the judiciary as is provided today in our Constitution.
Representative Smith, final question, just on this, on the mechanics of that. Would it be the entire 201 legislators sit in review of a judge's conduct? Would there be a committee, a subcommittee? Would it belong to the ethics committee? Do you see the whole legislature sitting in a review of a judge, or a committee doing it?
Mr. Nathan.
Thank you. The proposed bill that is now before the legislature specifies that four senators and four representatives would constitute the Judicial Standards Board. That same bill gives the legislature the power and authority to discipline judges if they disobey the law or refuse to apply the law. That's the extent of the proposal so far.
Mr. Chairman, this is my final
Smith.
Comment. So a board on judicial standards is a good thing. You just want different faces on it. Isn't that correct?
Mr. Nathan.
Thank you. Representative Smith.
Yes or no, Mr. Nathan? And then answer your, and then you can fill
Representative
in.
Smith.
The answer is
Mr.
no.
Chairman, sorry.
And the reason is we need effective oversight. We need to have consequences in place for judges who reject the law, who do not follow the rules, who violate the constitutions. There needs to be some discipline there. These too many judges just assume too much power. They hurt too many people.
And thank you for your patience, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Smith, no further questions. Thank you, Mr. Nathan. Representative Lesh. Again, we urge you to be brief in your question and brief in the response.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Nathan, you just stated that you thought that, well, we need to have consequences for conduct of a judge. Why are elections every 6 years for a judge an inadequate consequence? Is one question. The second question is, have you or anyone associated with you ever taken action in a political campaign against a judge and highlighted those issues for the public to ensure they were defeated in the election?
Mr. Nathan.
Representative Lesh, yes. We have highlighted it to the legislature as well as the public. There are groups such as the GOP chairs who are working as hard as we can to bring some relief to this situation. There are proposals, for example, that Minnesota have performance evaluation of judges, as 14 other states have, and that the evaluators send voters a report at election time about how the judges are performing their jobs. This is a form of oversight. And so why Minnesota hasn't done that when so many other states have is something that boggles my mind. And yes, we are campaigning to get that particular reform.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Lane.
If I can, well, that's one differing way, Mr. Nathan, that you could have accountability. But we have accountability in place right now. You can defeat a judge in their election. Why is that an inadequate system?
Mr. Nathan.
Thank you. Representative Lesh, most judges who run in so-called elections, run unopposed as the incumbent with the built-in advantages of having no opponent and being the incumbent. It is rare that an incumbent judge even has a challenge. Over 93% of Minnesota's judges are appointed by the governor, and that's a political process. So I beg to differ with the assumption that there is accountability to the people. In my view, there is not.
Sure. Well, Mr. Chair, just by way of
Representative Lesh,
you know, I'm surprised, Mr. Nathan, from my experience and my working in the Ramsey County courts, I know many judges who got in their office originally by an election. I also know that judges are terribly nervous around election time. They'll hang out down in filing to see if anyone's even going to file against them, which I think is hilarious. Those of us who have to actually do elections and just filing someone against them, someone credible, would spook them enough to modify their behavior. They also don't have a campaign war chest put together in the hopes that they won't have to run. So anyone with, you know, pulls together $5,000 to $10,000, which is almost nothing in a campaign, can spook someone enough to modify their behavior. So, Mr. Nathan, I think that there is accountability in place. I just think that it's not used. That's it, Mr. Chair.
All right. Any final comment, Mr. Nathan? Otherwise, we'll move to our next testifier.
Just a brief comment, if I may, Representative Szymanski. You know, the so-called nervousness of judges when they have a challenge, first of all, they get a tremendous amount of financing from lawyers and law firms. I've gone over the records of the campaign contribution panel. They get tremendous amounts of contributions from special interests to make sure that they can win the campaign. You're right, they get nervous. They do raise the money. Judges, supposedly, they don't know who the contributors are, but they probably do. That's the system we are seeking to change.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Nathan, for your testimony. Our next testifier would be Linda Senst. Linda, did you wish to testify or would you like to pass? Ms. Senst, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the tape and proceed.
Right. My name is Linda Senst. I'm a private citizen. I'm a public health nurse in McLeod County, Glencoe, Minnesota. I am secretary of the McLeod BPOU. I am the vice chairperson for McLeod Alliance for Victims of Domestic Violence. And actually, Mr. Chair, I have some other guests here that I'd rather have speak, and I'm wondering if I can give the floor to them in deference.
You may.
Okay, thank you very much.
Please call for forward your first testifier.
Thank you so much.
Good morning, sir. Please have a chair and introduce yourself for the team.
Something to pass out.
I would remind the testifiers that our committee requirements are that they be distributed prior to the committee hearing. So
I did.
All right. Please introduce yourself for the tape. Proceed. We have several people. We'd ask you to limit it to about 2 minutes and address the subject of the Board of Judicial Standards specifically in your testimony.
Absolutely. Good morning. Thank you for taking the time to hear me. My name is Brad Kramer. I'm a private citizen. I live in Stearns County. I've recently been involved in a child protection matter that's actually taking place in Kandi, Ohio County, even though my children have never lived there. I'm a member of Justice for Parents and Children, which our mission is Justice for Parents and Children exists to be a voice and support for parents and children who have been harmed or exploited by an unjust and unaccountable legal, judicial, or government system. In my case, my parental rights have been terminated recently. And that decision came from Judge Donald Spilseth of the 8th Judicial District. And in several cases, he's broken several of the things that we've spoken about this morning here. Sleeping, not applying current Minnesota statutes, starting trial late, very late, oftentimes an hour or more late. Real briefly, my history is I have a degree in criminal justice. I'm currently employed. I have no criminal convictions or charges that have anything to do with child protection. I used to be a juvenile corrections officer, and I'm currently in school for my undergraduate degree in business management. In my case, the judge ignored several statutes, including Minnesota Statute 260C-178, Subdivision 3, Statute 260C-.301, Subdivision 3, Paragraph A, I was never allowed visitation with my children for about the year that the case was going on, which is in defiance of the Minnesota statute. My father or my family has never been allowed visitation in most cases. He's only seen his grandchildren one time in the past year. The judge did not enforce his own rulings in many situations. He did not force the county to file a termination of parental rights against my wife, who had made the frivolous claims even though she had her parental rights terminated in a previous case, which the law requires that CPS has to file a termination in that situation. The judge and
Mr. Kramer, if I may just ask, did you file a complaint with the Board of Judicial Standards, and what was your
Essentially, I'm fairly new to this process, and when I looked into it, when you realize that there really is nothing that even if they investigate and find the judge did this, that they're not going to take meaningful action with the recourse that we have right now, and the ability for them to retaliate against somebody who may make a complaint against them, I mean, I'm still involved in the court proceedings. So if I take a course of action to file a complaint, and even at best case scenario, they find that the judge has committed these acts, there really is no meaningful discipline for the judge by the standards that we have presently. So essentially, no, I have not filed this complaint with the process that we have right now, as I feel it's inadequate and wouldn't address what I have. So that really leads me to the Court of Appeals is my only recourse presently, and that will take up to a year to receive a decision, and I've already paid $25,000 in legal fees just for the appeal, plus possibly $10,000 just for the transcripts that are required for the appeal. So we're talking a very expensive and long process while my kids are in foster care, while they have family that would love to provide for them. Right now they're the taxpayers are providing for them when I would love to. I'm not even allowed to provide financially for my children when I want to. But instead the taxpayers are picking up the bill and my children are in foster care. Five of my seven children are. The judge and CPS ignored findings by Midwest Children's Resource Center. He actually slept through their testimony when these were expert psychologists who basically said that my children did not exhibit the symptoms that CPS claimed they did.
Mr. Kramer, we need to move along with our other testifiers. Do you want to summarize your testimony so we can complete this hearing today? We'd like to complete the hearing today, so if you could summarize your testimony, and we'll get to the next testifier.
Okay, I'm almost done. Basically, he's in several situations broken these codes of conduct, and I have no recourse in the situation that we have now. Sleeping through testimony. Starting court late, not following or applying Minnesota statutes in his rulings, not giving me visitation when the law demands that I have it, things like that. That now my children, which in my packet that I've given you, there's pictures of my children with my family, with myself. They're not just a case. Those are a family that's broken up from the situation that we have right now. In three separate foster homes, including the picture of the foster family that you see there, when the children have family that loves them and hasn't been allowed to even see them, even though, like my father, who's present, has no criminal history. He's a prominent business owner. He went to Brazil with government Palenti a few years ago on a trade mission. Stellar person, but has not been allowed to see his own grandchildren because of the process that we have in place right now. And I understand that In our democracy and the judicial system, there's always going to be people who are not happy with the ruling that they receive. I understand that. I understand that the Court of Appeals is there to satisfy that. But on the other hand, when you have judges basically who are being watched over by members of their own fraternity, and it's a very close-knit group, where they're not going to take that action against each other, we need another board.
Yeah. Mr. Kramer, I'm going to have to cut you off at this point and ask our next testifiers to come forward.
Thank you.
And if you'd like to come up two at a time and use both chairs, that would be permissible here in the committee. So please step forward and introduce yourselves for the tape. first one, then the other, and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning. My name is Leah Bankin. I am a resident of Carver County, and I live in Waconia, Minnesota. I am the individual that Dale Nathan spoke earlier about that is ordered to remove a blog from the internet. I received that order last August 5th, 2011. I also have not seen my infant and two children in 8 months with no reason whatsoever listed. There's quite a few statutes and laws that are being ignored. In my case, I did actually contact the Board of Judicial Standards. The first time I know I didn't receive a call back. The second time was in August last year when I was ordered to remove a blog from the internet. And, you know, I asked him a series of questions. I said, you know, do you help out with U.S. Constitution being ignored? He said, no. I said, okay, well, you know, do you help out with statutes being ignored? He said, no. And I said, okay, well, how about, you know, a judge ruling bias? He said, no, which is, you know, I guess how it rules and it goes anyway. And I did ask what they do. He said if the judge is my brother or my mother, that they would actually find me a different judge. I said, well, thank you. I said, you know, should I file a complaint? He said, don't bother. We won't do anything. I have filed with the Court of Appeals, of course. I actually did file a writ of prohibition with the Minnesota Court of Appeals, which is pretty much an emergency appeal, trying to get contact to my infant and children. And the blog, I've been charged about $9,000 right now for this blog that is on the internet, and the blog is carvercountycorruption.wordpress.com that has court documents and criminal reports and facts on the case. And of course, they're not happy about that because what's coming out, what they're doing in these cases. There's quite a few in Carver County and around Minnesota. And so I've been ordered, it's about $9,000 docketing and judgment where they can garnish my wages and seize my bank accounts for this blog. So I filed a writ of prohibition, which was denied. So the appeal is actually accepted. And I will say on the appeals remedy, it takes about 9 months. My children are beyond devastated at this point. The baby doesn't even know she has a mother. She was taken at 11 weeks old, and there's no reason for it. And the Court of Appeals is going to take 9 months. And that is not an adequate remedy. On top of that, if the appeals court does find that there was wrong rulings or statutes that are being ignored, they actually give it back to Judge Richard Perkins, which did it in the first place. So the appeals court is not a proper remedy. So that's all I have to say.
Thank you, Ms. Parkin.
Hi, next, my name is Bonnie Roy, and I'm also a result of some negative influences from Carver County again. We're here to also support the bill that has to look at the judicial process. Right now we have, all of us in this room have spent an extravagant amount of money just to go through the court process.
Ms. Roy, if I may just remind you that we're here to talk about the Board of Judicial Standards today.
Thank you. In my case, I did send actually 3 letters to the Judicial Board. I do agree that on the letter it did state that the board has no legal authority to correct factual or legal mistakes in the court decision. For an example, you allege that Judge Canning did not consider certain evidence, nor did he not correct a fair ruling. The board's inability to consider these questions has nothing to do with whether these matters have been handled correctly or not. These questions are answered by the court system and not by the board. And again, I actually filed a complaint to the first judicial judge, Edward Lynch, and he basically said I need to go in front of a Canning, and I went back there again, and it's basically like a hamster on a wheel. I get nowhere. The costs are astronomical. I basically submitted another letter. That one was in January. I submitted another letter in response March of 8th, and it basically says again that the board is limited to their power in regarding even if they find allegations that are incorrect or correct against the law, which, again, we're up against a wall. We have nowhere to go. Again, in another letter I received in September 27th, it says right on here, again, the board has no legal authority to correct factual or legal mistakes. All of our cases have concrete evidence that the judges right here are committing and not abiding by the state statute of limitations in regards to child custody and child support. In regards to a guardian ad litem that specifically was on my case, these guardians are trained 20 hours. They are making court cases to these judges that are ripping families apart. This has to end. In regards to the court costs, anytime family law is stipulated, and it also included my complaint to the judicial board, it basically said, again, goes back to Judge Canning, I can't get nowhere. I try to appeal it. I do modifications, and he basically says he stands as ruled. I have solid concrete documents that I presented to him at one point, 350 documents that showed fraud. You know what Judge Canning allowed? He said it's stricken from the court. Judges need to be held accountable for their actions. These actions of court officials need to stop ruining and devastating the lives of family. This is not about family law and justice. It's about tearing and devastating the lives, and parents are the end result of traumatic suffering of children in the family court, and I plead with you that this can change.
Thank you, Ms. Roy. And the next person to testify, please introduce yourself for the tape, and again, address your comments to the Board of Judicial Standards.
So my name is Edna Vasilovsky. I'm an intellectual property attorney. My parents are actually immigrants. They came to the U.S. with nothing, and despite that, I managed to receive education at Stanford, Harvard, and Columbia, so I'm actually a big believer in America and the American system. But I've had some experiences in the court system that have, I guess, inspired me to come here. I had some prepared comments. I'm going to deviate. Instead, I want to address some comments that the speaker from the Board of Judicial Standards made. One comment that he made is that complainants have a zone of safety and that their identities aren't revealed. And so they can go to the board and not fear any backlash from the judge. I did not file a complaint with the Board of Judicial Standards because I had several phone calls with them where they emphatically stated that my identity, in fact, would be revealed. And I have their website here. Their website states under frequently asked questions, will my identity be revealed to the judge? Generally, yes. The board notifies judges about complaints unless there's an overriding reason to withhold this information. Will my complaint be made public? Usually, no. So the point of this statement is two things. One, all the Board of Judicial Standards does is provide a zone of safety for judges because the complainant's identity is revealed to the judge. The complainant is then prevented from participating in any proceedings, so the confidentiality is to benefit the judge, doesn't allow the complainant. And then the confidentiality is also from the public. They're not allowed to know what's going on. This kind of goes to a second point, which had to do with elections. I actually thought about, you know, what can I do to help improve the system? And I said, you know, maybe I'll run for judge. And I looked into it, and part of the problem is they have these six-year terms. In 6 years, they can cause a lot of damage. Secondly, because everything that happens in the board is confidential, the information isn't out there to the public, so they can't know. Lastly, there's an issue of what is their scope of authority, and then is their scope of authority actually effective? And it's fairly limited, so it doesn't address a lot of the harms we experience. Again, in the frequently asked questions, it says, you know, what are some examples they can address? Improper courtroom demeanor, failing to promptly dispose of judicial business, conflict of interest, chemical abuse, engaging in improper election campaign activities. Those are not only tangential, but almost irrelevant to the real serious issues that we experience and they can't handle. And the last thing is the issue of even if they had the proper scope of authority or even if they did their job within their scope of authority, is it really effective? And the answer is often no, because the judge who, all they can do is offer a recommendation. The judge can then take that back into the court system who can overturn it. And I believe the speaker gave an example of Judge Blakely, accepted a $64,000 discount on his bill from his lawyer in order to refer clients to that lawyer. My understanding is the judicial board recommended that judge be dismissed, and the court system instead gave him a 6 month paid leave. So basically he got a paid vacation, 6 months, who wouldn't take that, plus a $64,000 discount on his bill for wrongdoing. So I know we have limited time. I won't say what I was going to say, but I thought that was important.
Thank you, Mr. Vasilovsky. And proceed. Introduce yourself for the tape and provide your testimony, again, pertinent to the Board of Judicial Standards.
My name is Linnell Stroder, and I am just a lay person, meaning that I'm just a mother. And the reason why I'm here today in regards to the judicial Responsibility Board is because I filed a complaint back in 2005. I was locked up in the Carver County Jail. My bail was set at $100,000 for a gross misdemeanor. And what is so pertinent about this is that it was in correlation to having lost my parental rights. Not only had I lost my parental rights, where a lot of the laws were violated, they flew out of state and picked up my children. I had a judge that was unbiased and prejudiced, to where he filed the complaint, and out of that, he's the same judge that terminated my rights. But during my appeal time, I sat in their jail with $100,000 bail, with blank search warrants, with the court hearings being bifurcated, and the only place that I could go to that I knew to go to was the Lawyers Responsibility Board, the Judicial Board, and to the State Public Defender's Office. And so if we don't have somebody to go into that says that not only is there, that they would only look into personal misconduct, but what about the professional misconduct? What about the blatant disregard for the statutes and the laws? If I don't know the law, all I know is something's being done wrong. And so when I appeal to a board like the Responsibility Board, I would hope that they would at least investigate. To say the least, that I was, the charges were eventually dismissed, but they came at the dismissal once I made this complaint to the Responsibility Board. But the response that I got back to them was, well, it looks like it's been taken care of, so there's no need to investigate. But I believe had they continued to investigate that, they would have seen the intrinsic fraud that goes on within these court systems, and that right now today I have an 18-year-old who's been given back to me that's gone through 19 foster homes, 11 different group homes, that is just uncomprehensible. What do I do with this child? But I believe that if the Responsibility Board or there was somebody that would look in and at least investigate these things, that what we are coming here are not just frivolous complaints that saying, oh, we lost, or they just ruled, or should they or could they rule this way, but that there's a blatant disregard for the statutes and laws that we the people are asking that the committee and that you as representatives would look into and uphold. And that's all that I have to say.
Thank you, Mr.
Chair. I have a quick question.
Representative Lesh.
Thank you.
What kind of gross misdemeanor are you going to sit in jail on $100,000 bail on?
Exactly. It was a conspiracy to possess counterfeit checks, and there was no co-conspirators. There were blank search warrants. They were getting evidence from Ramsey County. They were bifurcating it. I had about 4 discovery hearings. The judge specifically would not allow me to speak. I ended up filing a complaint that I have here that went all the way that on my own, and all I carry is a GD, but...
If
yes.
It came as just briefly, so was this multiple counts then that you were...
No, it was one count. And it was given, and they filed it. It was from the child protection supervisor. So it was filed right after they took my child protection rights, and I went to appeal. And it was eventually dismissed.
Well, I'll ask offline about it, Mr. Chair. Gross misdemeanors are capped at $12,000 bail unless you have domestic assault, in which case it's... $30,000.
It was $100,000
would be a felony. But anyway, I'll ask offline, Mr. Chair.
All right. Thank you, Representative Lesh. Thank you, Ms. Schroeder. Do we have one more testifier yet?
Yes.
Okay. We have just 2 minutes left in our committee hearing. So.
Okay. My name is John McGrath. I'm the parent of 2 children. I've been involved in the family court for the last 5 years. I'm going to read to you briefly a short letter from my daughter. Mom and my brother kept saying, you better come home. They told me to say, I promise I'll come home tonight. I didn't say it because I was going to stay at Dad's. They kept intimidating me. Mom told my brother to say why he wanted me to stay. He said because he was lonely. Before I left, Mom said she'd burn all the stuff in my room if I don't come home. She laughed as if it was a joke. I'm afraid of what else my mom might do to me because she's been yelling and getting angry a lot. What we're dealing with here, and I appreciate the time that you've given us, is a travesty of our society that is destroying the lives of healthy children and healthy parents. This is an outrage, and it is because the judicial system in this state has absolutely no accountability whatsoever. It's the proverbial fox watching the hen house. I would beg you to take the time to look at all of these cases here, and what is going on in Carver County right now is an outrage. They are basically operating as an organized crime syndicate under the guise of the law. They are destroying 8 children that I know of. They're destroying their lives. They know exactly what they're doing, and it's all for the money. They have pools of money that they receive from state and federal government coffers that are opened wide when they bring into the situation all kinds of conflict, and you need social workers and therapists and psychologists involved. It is an outrage. You people are the ones who are responsible for changing the system to protect our children. And this happens in the family court system and in the criminal system because the victims are made powerless and they can keep it a secret.
Okay. Mr. McGrath?
Yes, sir.
Okay. We have one more testifier, if we may proceed with his testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Greg Wurzel. I'm an attorney. I've practiced law for over 30 years. I'm going to make some recommendations about what I think needs to be done. First of all, I think a lot of the problems and a lot of the anger is caused by the fact that the Board on Judicial Standards, their hearings, their procedures are not open to the public. There's no transparency. I myself have filed complaints with the board. You get a letter back 6 months later that says we're not proceeding, and you don't know that they've ever actually listened to what you had to say. You don't know what the judge said in response, and you weren't given a chance to respond to what the judge said. And it seemed to me to be a total waste of time, and I've talked to other lawyers, and they are of the similar opinion. So my first suggestion is these things need to be made open to the public. There needs to be far more transparency. Secondly, the board needs to look at judges' decisions. They take a policy that they will not look at a decision that's appealable, but I'm going to tell you, we have judges out there who are refusing to follow the law. They know they're refusing to follow the law. I've had judges say they're refusing to follow the law. Now, this isn't entirely the problem of the board. It's part of the process, the problem with the process. And I'll give you an example. Because the process ends with the Minnesota Supreme Court, and that is part of the problem. In Kandy, Ohio County, we had a judge who refused to follow state law on repeat DWIs. The law says that either the person is supposed to post $10,000 bail or be put on an alcohol sensor. The judge would refuse to do both. The county attorney objected. The issue ended up finally in front of the Minnesota Supreme Court, and instead of telling the judge to follow the law, the court threatened the county attorney that if he continued to file complaints and remove the judge, that attorney would lose his license. That's part of the problem, is that we have this process ends with the state Supreme Court. My suggestion is, right now, the rules should be created, the rules that the judges follow should be created by the legislature. Right now, they've been created by your Minnesota Supreme Court. They only did that pursuant to a statute you created that actually established the Board on Judicial Standards. My suggestion is that you remove that final appeal to the Minnesota Supreme Court. Again, there was testimony here today that the board would have removed Judge Blakely from office, and the board would have removed Judge Karasoff from office. But the Minnesota Supreme Court, putting one judge in charge of other judges, only remove them from office for a short period of time. I think a judge who lies, which is what was said of Judge Karasoff, should be removed from office. I think if you did not live in your district, you would be removed from office. Finally, the suggestion has been made that elections are a possible solution, and I fully agree, but you have to have elections that work. These elections we have in our state do not work. The primary problem is that the word incumbent makes it almost impossible for anybody, which is found on the ballot only in judicial elections, makes it almost impossible for anybody to successfully defeat an incumbent. In the last 50 years, no incumbent judge on the Minnesota Supreme Court has been defeated in an election, and no incumbent judge on the Minnesota Court of Appeals has ever been defeated in an election in the entire existence of the court. The election system is not working. Give us a system where we can remove judges, where we can hold them accountable, and you will not have angry people in your presence anymore. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wurzel, for your testimony. Our time for this committee has expired, sir.
I've waited 20 years to have a shot. This is what I would like to
do. Pardon? Sir, just let me consult with my vice chair and my BFL lead.
Yeah,
sure. All right. Okay. Sir, we will concede. We will give you 2 minutes.
Okay. First, let me, in a
Please identify yourself for the team.
My name is Don Mashick. I live in Monticello, Minnesota. I'm going to first try to paraphrase some thoughts, and I don't know who to directly attribute them to, whether it's Founding Fathers, Cato, or Aristotle. But basically, there's a concept called first principles. And one of the first principles that the founders had in founding this country was that men by nature have free will, and men are not virtuous. And therefore, we must construct government to protect all men from each other. It disappoints me that this committee allowed somebody to say, why is there a camera here? That is the very transparency we're talking about. On the specific point of the Board of Judicial Standards, it is a joke. It is an absolute joke. And one of the things I don't think anybody's brought up is the standards of evidence. You have the preponderance of evidence, you have beyond a reasonable doubt, and then in the Board of Judicial Standards, you've got clear and convincing. So I can't think of anything more difficult than proving that a bunch of lawyers and judges are corrupt, whose profession it is to play with words. Clear and convincing. By the time you realize you've been screwed by your own attorney or the judge, you're not allowed to record anything. So where's your clear and convincing? Transcripts get altered all the time. This is ridiculous. And just to give you an example of what happens when you folks aren't transparent and you folks don't hold people accountable, I want to refer you to Fabian versus Volkmer, A10-1205. Your own district court, your own appellate court, your own Supreme Court ruled that lawyers do not have to treat their clients with integrity. They ruled that the lawyers' code of professional conduct is not an implied covenant of a contract between a citizen and a Minnesota lawyer. And you folks have done nothing about that. How do you let that go? And that's not something you can appeal to the Board of Judicial Standards. I spent $20,000 on an attorney. Never got in 2 years. No deposition. Discovery on the very last day. And didn't get my to amend the complaint. And they want to rule that I agree. It was my fault. $20,000. And you let them rule. Where are you people not outraged that they ruled that lawyers don't have to treat citizens with integrity?
Thank you, Mr. Marsh, for your testimony. Having expired our committee time, this committee is adjourned. Next committee hearing will be Thursday, February 16th, 8:15 a.m. We are adjourned.